Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with T. Clark, whose new book of short stories is All This Want and I Can't Get None, and Melissa Daggett, whose new work of history is Eugene and Eulalie, a family saga of love, race, and property in 19th century New Orleans. Every now and then, a fresh new fictional voice arrives, articulating the concerns of a generation. T. Clark possesses just such a voice. T.'s first collection is All This Want and I Can't Get None. These characters are mostly young folks looking for love and acceptance, longing for better lives, but just not sure how to move on up. T. Clark, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Now, you're from Westchester County, New York. You've been to Rutgers University, and you received an MFA in fiction from Bloomington, and you've won lots of prestigious awards. But the one I'm most curious about is the Writer in the World Award.
Oh, sure.
Which took you to Nepal.
Yeah, yeah.
A world away from these characters.
That's right. That's right.
So how did that happen?
One of my grad school professors is from Nepal, and so he has funding that every year he gets to take two or three students on a trip. So I won that award, and that was the first time I used a passport, first time I left the country, and
wow.
It really changed the way I think about things.
And you think that's going to pop up in later work?
You know, I wrote something when I was there that I kept one moment from it. We'll see if it ends up being in Nepal. But I think the idea of leaving the country was really important for me with writing, because getting away from where I am, it makes it easier to reflect on where I've been.
But that seemed to me a world away from the places in these stories.
Right.
So it was intriguing
right.
to read about that.
Right.
So tell us your New Orleans story. What brought you here?
Sure. I came here in 2017 for a writing residency that is now defunct. It was the New Orleans Writers Residency. There's this little red house next to CVS on Elysian and Claiborne.
Uh-huh.
That was a residency for a couple years. So I was living in LA. That wasn't the right fit for me. And someone I knew who was in New Orleans was like, you should come check it out. You might like it. So I came here deep in the summer. There were storms, the power went out, we were cramped in a little shotgun, and I remember just being so hot and fanning myself and saying, this is the most fun I've ever had. And so then I moved to Wisconsin for 10 months for a fellowship, and after that, came back here.
So I think you're going to stay.
I think I'm going to stay.
For a while, yeah.
I think I'll be here.
Such a good community.
Yeah.
Strong community of supporters for writers here,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. And for people. People who aren't
general.
Writers. Like, the writing community is so generous, and I feel held. And also, many of my friends are readers, but certainly not writers. And
yeah.
I think they also have my back. It's really nice here for that.
Well, you are writing such distinctive characters, and you have such a distinctive voice.
Thank
and
you.
I wanted you to start, if you don't mind, by reading the first paragraph of the opening story.
Sure. Sure. So this is from the story All This Want and I Can't Get None. There's cereal at my mom's, but the milk is expired, and I'm already late for school, so I don't have time to scramble eggs, which we don't have, or mix Bisquick, which we also don't have, anyway. If I didn't sleep through two alarms, I could have stopped by the bodega for a butter roll and a sun-kissed and been on my merry way down Fifth Ave to the bus stop. Instead, I got nothing but a growling stomach coated in lukewarm water from the few sips from the water fountain outside Mrs. Carter's class. In elementary school, I used to always be jealous of white kids with moms who put lunch in a bag and wrote their name on it in marker. My mom never had time for that. That's why when she found out I was hanging around Tevin's place with some of the kids from school, she was like, at least he got food there, and didn't say another word about it. Plus, I'm 13 now, which to her might as well be a grown-ass woman.
13.
13.
And having to think about food and those things.
Yeah.
Everything in these stories is so tenuous and contingent upon things over which lots of times the characters have no control.
That's right.
It's very difficult. Uh-huh. So what was it that drew you to short stories in the beginning?
Part of it is just the nature of the creative writing academic track. I studied creative writing in undergrad a little bit and then went to grad school. And since there's workshop, meaning you turn in a story twice or three times a semester, it made sense to be writing stories. And so those are the things I was focusing on, and I really got into them. I love reading stories, and that was just the culmination of all of my work.
Who are your favorite short story writers?
I love Raymond Carver as like my oldest, dearest favorite, yeah, for sure. Really love Danielle Evans. I think she's great. Dantil Moniz, really great. Lady Hubbard, local, really great. Mm-hmm.
So the thing about short stories to me is that there's a lot of freedom there, but there's also demands.
Urgency.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And just getting enough without too much.
Right.
So how many times would you say you write a short story?
Oh, that's a great way to think about it. I don't really often write a story from beginning to end more than once, but I think the way my process works, I end up writing the beginning many, many times. And once I feel like I have my footing, then the rest of it kind of unfolds naturally. So it's less about rewriting the story and more about getting into the right room and the right head and the right voice. And once I find that stuff, it just sort of moves forward. That's what propels it.
Now, these are stories of girls and women and non-binary characters who are looking for love, looking for acceptance, looking for themselves, really. And in Walks Like a Duck, young April and her friend Itara are looking at a book called Other Girls. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to reason things out. And April says, sometimes they don't know they're lesbian until they kiss a girl. I've never kissed a girl, so that's why I'm not sure. As far as Itara knew, April never kissed a boy either. Neither of them had. But they're on the precipice of all that. And that's the moment that you seem to seize upon that offers all this potential for a writer. Uh-huh. So talk about finding that moment.
Yeah, in hindsight, it feels a little bit like, well, I think about climax in stories, and sometimes that is the idea that I have first. Often I'll have like the first line, but then I'll know that there's a moment that I'm writing towards. And so I think it's really important in short stories to get in and get out as soon as possible, like start to as close to the end as you can. With that story, I wanted to leave it at a point where the characters had learned something, but then the thing that they learned also opened up a whole other sea of questions, right? So we know what they're searching for. They come to some conclusion, but then the outside world has something to say about it, mm-hmm, if that makes sense. So I think I'm thinking about like characters' agency and characters doing what they want, and then circumstance and outsiders and power structures kind of put a squash on a lot of what they want to do.
Well, talk about your story, A Great Dad, in those terms, because that's one where all those things are crystallized, I think.
Sure, yeah. So full disclosure, I used to live in Virginia, and I worked at a TGI Fridays, and I was so used to, it was like TGI Fridays, Home Goods, Gun Store, Pawn Shop, Chili's, Cheddar's, Pizza Hut. It was just like all of these places in a row, and I just thought about a character who would be moving through those places. And you know, people in the restaurant industry can probably relate to, there's like weird hours and there's access to people and alcohol and partying and all of that. And so thinking about someone who works in the kitchen but has like a secret real life and trying to make their way there and the struggles that they would go through, mm-hmm, that's kind of what I was thinking about in that story. And the moment of climax in that one also does come in the end for me. I was writing not exactly towards that moment, but I knew that there was gonna be some sort of interaction or lack of. That was my path, that was the journey.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with T. Clark, whose new short story collection is All This Want and I Can't Get One. It's odd. In 1 week, I've read two stories, uh-huh, about young characters trying to be good dads. And the world places every obstacle in their ways. Uh-huh. They just can't move forward. It strikes me as a sad commentary on where we are now. You know, that we are not enabling.
Yes. I'm at the age now where a lot of my friends are starting to have kids, and all of the men in those situations to me seem like they're gonna be wonderful fathers. So I hope that we are looking in a different direction, but I can also speak to just experiencing Father's Day and how many of my friends were like, haven't heard from him in some time, you know? I don't really have a relationship with my dad at this point, so I can imagine how a dad like Cliff could exist.
Yeah.
And like, sure. Why a dad like Cliff would exist.
Mm-hmm. You have such a range, though, of things that you do. And there's one story that is about the cruelties young girls can inflict on each other. And that's the thing about you.
Uh-huh.
So talk about that.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it was my editor who said this. She is also a Black woman. But she was like, does every Black girl have a sleepover in a hotel? Like, apparently that is a really common thing. And then thinking about what it's like to be the odd one out of a group, and how that dynamic can really show up when you're in this pressure cooker of a Marriott, you know?
Yeah.
I was really interested in exploring hindsight. And so looking at these characters in present day and then thinking back to this particular time in their life, that is this relatable experience, and how time and memory can really change depending on the moment that you're in.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a novel.
Yay!
Yeah. Yeah, it's very exciting. It's very exciting. There is a lot of work still to do, but I'm enjoying living with the character and thinking about where this is going. It's explicitly about a mother-daughter relationship and how that relationship evolves over the course of maybe 15 years.
Does it feel good to you to stretch in that way?
The possibility sounds good. Let's say that. I think so much in moments that the novel for me feels right now just like a bunch of moments stacked on top of each other. And so working through lines, working through things that really require stretching, that's the hard work of the novel right now.
Have you found being in New Orleans has changed you in any important way?
Every important way. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. One, community is huge here, and feeling support is huge. I also know myself better than I did yesterday, and hopefully will know myself better tomorrow. And I don't know that I was experiencing that rate of growth in my past. Or like, maybe I was experiencing the growth, but didn't really have a place to put it or a real understanding of it. And I think that New Orleans, at least the people that I'm around, are all introspective and thoughtful and helpful and smart and curious. And so being with them has really changed my life.
I can't tell you how many people have sat in a writer's chair and said to me, I got here and I got to be myself.
Right, right.
Which is the gift that New Orleans keeps on giving.
That's right.
For writers, I think.
That's right. I think it's a little bit similar in a couple places like New York City, in that you can't really surprise anyone in New Orleans with a personality type or an outfit or a concept, you know, like New Orleanians have seen it all. And so it's fun to get to try on different ways of being and still feel connected to an authentic self. Whereas what I do have in common with the girls in these books is just like having to mask just because there are so many questions inside. And I feel like here the answers are just like, the writing's on the wall.
Yeah.
While it's a mysterious place, it's also kind of straightforward. And like, this is how you treat people. This is how you interact. This is what you do.
So take us out with a little bit of The Girl Gets Whatever She Wants.
Sure. The Girl Gets Whatever She Wants. Troy got Chrissy a room at the Showboat Casino for her 23rd birthday. Though not her first choice, a trip to Atlantic City was at least more promising than her last birthday, when Troy brought home a bottle of Jack Daniels and a small unfrosted sheet cake from Sam's Club. There had been a six-pack of Stella's in the fridge, so why bring her a bottle of wine? Sure, he could have gotten a drink she could stomach, but she did claim sheet cake was her favorite dessert, and some boyfriends out there didn't remember their girls' birthdays at all. When he told her about his plans for this year, and after her momentary disappointment, which he tried to hide, she smiled wide and asked if they could switch to Revel, the new casino down the road. That's where the young people went. It had a burlesque club that gave lessons in the daytime, and all those rooms faced the ocean. Imagine waking up and looking out at the Atlantic, vast and deep and blue. Plus, there were good nightclubs at Revel. Chrissy wanted to dance on her birthday. Showboat had no clubs. Showboat was for grandpas. Troy sucked in his bottom lip and bit off the chapped spots. Chrissy inhaled for four through her nose and adjusted her smile so it was more playful, sexy, more in the eyes. "Baby, thank you," she said. "I'm sorry." She crossed their living room and put a hand on his shoulder and ran it down his bicep. She hugged around his slack arms, pressing her soft morning body into his. "It's because your friends go to Revel?" he asked. "That's why you want to go?" "No, Troy, it's not because my friends go there," she said. "It's fine. Showboat sounds great. You went there with Tosh and them, right? What, you met a boyfriend there?" "Babe, no, I wasn't thinking. Showboat's the Mardi Gras one, right?" "Yeah," he said. He looked away and down a little. "I love Mardi Gras." "You've never been to Mardi Gras." "Yeah, but I watch TV," she said. "Maybe I'll get some beads from an old guy." She moved into his eyesight and lifted her big t-shirt up. "Mardi Gras," she said. "Woo, throw me something." "Oh, some old guy," he said. "I dare you." She flashed him again and again until he chased her around the dining room, making loops around their love seat. He grabbed her waist on both sides and pushed her down onto it. As he looked into her eyes, she smiled up at him with gratitude. She was so charming sometimes, she almost fooled herself.
Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras.
Everywhere.
Woo.
Woo. Exactly. Yeah. We've been talking with T. Clark, whose brilliant news story collection is All This Want and I Can't Get None. T., thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure to welcome Melissa Daggett back to The Reading Life. She's a former professor of history at San Jacinto College, and her first book was Spiritualism in 19th Century New Orleans, The Life and Times of Henry Louis Ray. She has a real knack for teasing out the strands of meaning in our past history, and now she's back with Eugene and Eulalie, a family saga of love, race, and property in 19th Century New Orleans. Melissa Daggett, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, it's such a fascinating story. First of all, it's a real-life 50-year love story, which is itself pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes. When I would tell friends about the book, they always thought this was fiction. It was just too crazy and too different. It sounded like a plot from a Netflix movie or something. So people thought that it was not nonfiction.
And tell us about Eulalie, who was born in 1774.
She was born, we don't know the exact date, we do know the year. She was the product of a slave who was owned by Pierre Marigny, who was an extremely wealthy elite man in Louisiana. And at first she lived on Pierre's plantation, but then he moved her to his mother's house in St. Bernard Parish, and this was what they called a donation. So you have the original papers, the original archival papers that show she was a donation, and that was when she was a very small child. Now, a few years later, in 1779, she was emancipated. At that point, was a free person of color, and she continued to live with her grandmother on the plantation, and she lived there until her grandmother died. At that point, the plantation was exchanged for some other land, and Pierre Marigny then owned an area in what we call today the Marigny, the Faubourg Marigny.
It seems so amazing to think of a five-year-old needing to be freed. You know, it's just mind-boggling, I think. And her partner and eventual husband was Eugene McCarty. You might think such a relationship would be impossible, but it really wasn't those times.
No, it was actually fairly common for interracial relationships, and not the ones that would just last a year or two when both were very young. There were many relationships that lasted for decades, very similar to what we think of as a regular marriage. So she met her partner, we don't know exactly when, but it would have been in the early 1790s. They started having children together. They eventually had seven children, but five of them lived to adulthood. And of those five, there was one girl and four boys.
Now, one of the things that's so much fun in reading this book is your sourcing. You talk about so many different things, ecclesiastical records, different sets of family papers, the Vieux-Carré survey. You look up their houses to see what they're like, the database that Gwendolyn Middleham Hall created. Even talking with the descendant of one of the Maronis who had family papers. So talk about the allure of records and finding stories.
Well, the main source was the case. Now, the case comprised more than 300 pages. There was a lot of information there. For example, there were copies of letters that Eulalie's father had sent her. They weren't the actual letter, but we have copies of letters that were written in the 1790s. So think about that. That's amazing that we would have that. The other thing, that the other source you mentioned, or one of the sources, was the Vieux Carré Digital Survey. I highly recommend this for people doing research on their family, and maybe the family members own property in the French Quarter. So there's a huge amount of information there. In fact, one bit of information I found that really surprised me was that the original Maronis de Mandeville House is located at the Williams Research Center. All right, obviously it's not there anymore, but it occupied that space. And I was just so amazed because I had done a lot of research in that exact spot. So that's just to give you an example of what you can find out from this digital resource.
That's magical in a way, the way all things lead back to the Williams Research Center sometimes. Now, one of the things that I loved about this book was the way you would follow a thread to its conclusion. And take Delphine de McCarty LaLaurie, for example, who is one of the most notorious of French Quarter residents. How does she figure into this story?
Well, the lady you just mentioned was a niece of McCarty. And we don't have a whole lot of information of how much they interacted, but she was one of those collateral heirs, or potentially a collateral heir. And she figures in there. We do know that she eventually was driven out, literally driven out of town, and ended up in France. But while she was in France, her lawyer in New Orleans was handling her affairs. And the lawyer was the one who was helping out with this case. But that is interesting that she was connected to Eugene McCarty.
And Victor Eugene McCarty, who's one of Eugene's children by another woman, became a prominent musician and civil rights activist as well.
Yes, he was a very talented musician, and he was a very active civil rights activist. It looks like they really didn't have a connection. I mean, he was not included in any type of papers, legal papers. But oddly enough, that's how Eugene McCarty handled things with his other children from two other women. It seemed like he didn't have a connection with them, as far as I know. We'll never know for sure because he's gone. But as far as legal connections, it seems like there was nothing. Now, Victor Eugene McCarty did have connections with people connected to Eugene McCarty, but as far as him, it seemed like there was no relationship at all.
Well, one of the things that you do so well in this book is bring New Orleans to life in ways that I don't think I've really thought about before, like how commerce was conducted in the open-air commerce, how people would sell their stuff. You know, how people would come into contact with each other. Some funerals are in this as well, and the whole idea of the lawsuit. So I think it has a lot to teach us about societal ways in the 19th century, don't you? I mean, what do you think is the big takeaway from this lawsuit?
Part of it was the great legal team that Eulalie had. And part of it, in my opinion, is she was related to Bernard Maronis. Bernard Maronis by this time was in his, well, he was almost 60, but it was still very popular. And he was sort of like a star witness for his sister. He always had a connection with his sister. He always stood up for her. He helped her in her younger years with property and money. And Bernard Marini's input in the case, I think, helped out Eulalie because he's still a very prominent Creole. He was a quintessential Creole, in my opinion. So that definitely helped.
We've been talking with Melissa Daggett, whose new book is Eugene and Eulalie, A Family Saga of Love, Race, and Property in 19th Century New Orleans. Melissa, thanks so much.
And thank you for inviting me.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Charles Chip McGimsey presents a lecture, Mounting Evidence, Research on the LSU Campus Mounds at 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 7th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Kirsten Casey signs The Hands That Treat, Friday, July 10th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Karen Essex, an award-winning novelist, journalist, and screenwriter, will discuss her life as a screenwriter at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, July 11th at the Wagner Library in Metairie. Essex is the author of the national and international best-selling novel Leonardo's Swans, about the muses of Leonardo da Vinci, Stealing Athena, the story of the controversial Elgin Marbles, and Dracula in Love, a retelling of the original vampire tale.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.